You've all had some experience with neighbors. Well, we're going to talk about neighbors and what it is to be one. Perhaps in the element of full disclosure, I should tell you a little bit about one of my neighbors. That there had been some break-ins in our area. And this neighbor in particular, my next door neighbor, he had gone to the measures of installing security systems, alarms, and lights, and with motion sensors, and outdoor horn, and he had his trailer that he kept his quads in on the heaviest chain I think he could lift home from the hardware store, hooked to a tree. He had gone and installed all these things. He dug some wiring in so that he could have light shining in all various ways and places. And he asked me, "Bob, do you have a security system?" I said, "Yes, I do." He says, "Well, what kind of a security system do you have?" I said, "Well, I try to make sure that anything I have is at least 10 years older than yours." He didn't find it that funny. But nevertheless, my neighbor. Let's read from Luke chapter 10. Chapter 10, beginning at verse 25. On one occasion, an expert of the law stood up to test Jesus. "Teacher," he asked, "what must I do to inherit eternal life?" "What is written in the law?" Jesus replied. "How do you read it?" The expert answered, "Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and love your neighbor as yourself." "You've answered correctly," Jesus replied. "Do this and you'll live." But he wanted to justify himself, so he asked Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" In reply, Jesus said, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell in the hands of robbers. They stripped him of his clothes, beat him, and went away, leaving him half dead. A priest happened to be going down that same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. So too a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he traveled, came where the man was, and when he saw him, he took pity on him. He went to him and bandaged his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he put the man on his own donkey, took him to an inn, and took care of him. The next day he took out 2 silver coins and gave them to the innkeeper. 'Look after him,' he said, 'and when I return, I will reimburse you for the extra expense you may have.' Which of these 3 do you think was the neighbor to the man who fell in the hands of robbers?" The expert in the law replied, "The one who had mercy on him." Jesus told him, "Go and do likewise." What does it take to be a neighbor? When it says that it was an expert of the law, you see, that would be the law of Moses, and that he would have studied the Talmud and the traditions. He was a man who knew his Bible. He was going to put Jesus to the test, to challenge Jesus, to check out his stuff. And Jesus turns the question back to him. What is written? And he cites 2 passages from the law, from Deuteronomy and from Leviticus. And the summary is, love God and love others. And Jesus says, great summary. Way to go. Good points. And you see, what's written in the Deuteronomy passage, chapter 6, is that you and your children and their children after them, if you would live as God directs, you would enjoy life. And what is it to follow the Lord and to live with him now and forever? It's not theory. It's not a lot of head knowledge. It's not knowing the truth. But it's very practical. It's not just thinking and ideas. It's surrender of a life to receive God's love and to share God's love. You see, religion as man forms it tends to be a lot of forms and rituals. And this is describing something different. There is a bit of an irony that the passage in Deuteronomy says, you know, like, write these things on your forehead, you know, so you're going to remember them. And it says, and put them on your doorpost so when you come in and out, you're going to see this, how important it is, love God, love your neighbors. Well, what was said to say, make this a daily part of how you live, became attaching something to their foreheads and nailing something on their doorposts, but not necessarily changing how they lived. You see, we can sometimes get the symbol without the intent. We can get the form without the practicality of living it out. So this message has got to do with not just what the theory is or what we think. It's not just our feelings. It's got to do with a relationship. A relationship that those of you who have known and received the love of God, if you have tasted what it's like to experience God's love, to receive His grace, His forgiveness, then how can you do anything else but want to pass that love along wherever you see an opportunity? So, we love because He first loved us. And He showed us how to love. So how do you love God? You know, it's sort of like that question, you know, what do you get for somebody who has everything? And so when you want to give God a gift, when you want to just express your gratitude, when you're overwhelmed with how you want to bless God, He says, this is how you do it. The way you do it, when you know you're loved of God and you want to love God? Well, you know, it says, you know, with all your heart and your mind and, you know, strength. It says, the application of that is when we express that love to others. You see, that's how we love God. And so, He tells us to love our neighbors as yourself. Well, you think, you know, I mean, I work in counseling and I see a lot of people who are pretty self-contemptuous. They say a lot of negative things to themselves, and they say things to themselves they would never say to someone else, you know, because they're far too kind to do that. And I ask, well, why would you never say that to your friend or to your kids or to your family, you know? And they say, well, I love them. Huh. What if you were then to perhaps talk to yourself as though you were someone that you loved and that God loved you. So this isn't what it's saying when it says it loves you, this passage, when it says to love your neighbor as you love yourself. I think it's more akin not to self-concept or self-talk, because I really don't want you to treat your neighbors like you might talk to yourself. That isn't what we're going for. What we're going for is more akin to the fact that we will do what is in our self-interest rather than consider the interest and the needs of the other. And so love thinks about what someone else needs and what would bless them and what we could offer that would care for them. So it's saying we're in the same way that by nature we're out to take care of ourselves and our own self-interest. Supernaturally, you were purposed with the possibility of passing along love that considered the needs of another even before you focused on yourself. So, Jesus turns the question around. I don't know if you noticed that. There's some of you that are rather skilled at not answering the question you're asked. I actually encountered one of you this morning. And you very skillfully turned the subject around to something else rather than ask the question you were asked. However, and you know who you are. But the man asks, who is my neighbor? You see, he was a lawyer trying to justify himself. He was looking for the legal loophole. You know, there's a lot of people out there. There's a lot of problems. You can't look after them all. It's not my business. You know, I couldn't get anything done if I took, who is my neighbor anyway? Do you notice Jesus didn't answer that question? Jesus turned the question around and he asked the fellow, who was the neighbor? Which of these three men was the neighbor to the one who was left for dead? And you see, Jesus' concern is less. You see, there's lots of opportunities. And you set back into his ministry, while he was here, he didn't heal all the people. But he did have compassion and healed those where he had opportunity. And those that were in his path and where they had a willingness to receive what he would give. And so, I don't know who's going to be in your path that you can love as a neighbor. That will vary from day to day. Some of them will be ongoing connections and relationships, and others will be those that just happen in your way on that one moment. The question is less, who is my neighbor, than it is, will you be a neighbor? And so we're going to take a look at that, and we're going to take a closer look at what it takes to be a neighbor. What would it take to look like this Samaritan? All three of those who passed by saw the need. The need was clear and evident, but only one had the compassion to act. Only one was willing to make the interruption in his plans to stop. We see needs and sometimes we're overwhelmed. And it could be we're at a saturation point and we don't have more to expand to. There's an interesting thing in one of C.S. Lewis's books where he says that the enemy needn't tempt you with evil when he can just as easily wear you out tempting you by good. You see, so if you try to do all the good things that need to be done, you're still worn out and ineffective. And so in terms of, kind of picking, we talk about picking your fights. Well, you might want to pick where can I invest myself in the lives of others? And so it isn't whether I did it just right. You see, it has a whole lot more about availability. I'm really thinking that Samaritan on the way down the road, I don't think he was planning his day around, I wonder if there'll be any beaten people on the side of the road I could stop and help. Yeah, and you're not going to know when God gives you the opportunity to use what you've got for his glory. Because every time you're a reflection of God's love, people have a chance to see a little bit more of Jesus. Sometimes we're overwhelmed. Sometimes we're preoccupied. We're so busy thinking about whatever we're thinking about and we've made it so important, or sometimes we're trying to think and solve all of the world's problems that we miss noticing the need right in front of us. And sometimes we don't know what to do. So, let's look at what the Samaritan did. He stopped. He took time and attention. He set aside his plans and offered presents. I have a fellow that I know that his car stopped. It just stalled out and stopped on a very cold night driving home from Rocky Mountain House. Tuesday night, cold, stormy, kind of night. There wasn't much of traffic at all. He couldn't see any lights of houses in anywhere within the range that he could see. And he waited. 10, 15 minutes. It was almost 20 minutes till the first car passed by. And that's exactly what it did. It went on by. And very shortly after it, another one went too. So when a woman traveling in the opposite direction stopped and asked if he needed a ride, she had no mechanical ability. She didn't know how to fix his car. You know, what use was that? But what she did have was a warm car that was headed in the opposite direction he was intending to go. And he was delighted that he wasn't alone and that he could receive help. Now, to not be alone on the highway or in the hospital or when we're just lonely, someone to be there. And if life is so packed full, if you're so busy doing so many good and important things that there's no margin, there's no room or time to stop, then perhaps life is too full. To allow ourselves enough margin that we could stop. This would be a concept even, you know, if you to do that, like for instance, coming to church, you could actually leave early enough that if you needed to stop, you could. And then actually, you'd all be here on time. This could be life-changing, innovative. But that might apply to other things, too. Nevertheless, you don't want those sermons to be life-changing, do you? They gave the gift of time. It was an inconvenience. And sometimes, you see, it's an inconvenience. It's not an obligation. It's not something to be getting guilty over. You see, for some of you, you give a gift of time to help someone learn how to speak English. For others, you take time being with and supporting young parents by giving them some relief with their children. And others, it's volunteerism in the community. And each of those is a gift of time. A precious gift. Sometimes there's some risk involved. A risk that you're out of your comfort zone. Or you're doing something you're not sure of. You're not that confident. We need to measure that risk as to whether it's needed. And to be careful that we are not being reckless. That wouldn't be good stewardship either. And this guy was obviously in a bad neighborhood. You know, it was a place to ambush people. We need to make judgment calls about where and how and when we help. But sometimes we might choose, because we know the need is there, to go where it isn't as safe, because someone needs to go. But we measure that and to see, is it within my reach or are we overextended? Never an obligation. Guilt is never the motivation for Christian service. Now, I'll say that again because I don't think some of you think it's a virtue. Guilt is never a motivation for Christian service. Only and ever is the motivation for Christian service been out of love. Not out of have to, not out of should have, or I need to do more. And so to be able to say, it's a gift. And when you give the gift of time to people, when you make that effort, you see, he did what he could with what he had. He obviously must have known some measure of first aid. You know, I don't think he was just pouring random things on this fellow. He had some reason to think that the wine and the oil would help and that he could bandage this up. But you do need to keep a little bit in your scope of practice. We're not going to suggest that some of you do surgery because you come across someone who looks like they needed it. And by same token, sometimes when I teach people about emotional first aid, you see, everyone thinks, I won't know what to say. I say, there's no problem with that. You don't need to worry about not knowing what to say unless you insist on saying it. You see, rather to be quietly with someone listening and supporting than saying a bunch of stupid things that are just going to make their circumstance more miserable. So sometimes it's knowing our scope of practice and knowing when we need to ask for additional help, as he did. You see, he did the bandaging. For us, we may share a room with someone who needs to not be alone or needs shelter. We may share tools. I tried to share tools with a neighbor. My experience didn't go well, but our gifts won't always be received. But it doesn't mean it wasn't right to offer them. You see, we live in a place where we're very independent, you know, and we kind of don't need anybody. And we live with that lie and sometimes turn down the offer of community and caring. However, you might offer your tools or a helping hand. And sometimes, you see, nobody calls upon me for mechanical service. And that is wise. I can open the hood and look at it and think, yeah, it sure isn't running, is it? But past that point, I'm pretty sketchy on it. But you see, so we're not all designed to do the same things. But when you do have some abilities, some gifts, don't be surprised if God can use those to touch a heart, to assist. You know, for some of you, it's going to be in your kitchen. And food you prepare and share or offer hospitality with. And you see, we use what's at hand. That could be a listening ear. It could be words of encouragement. It could be offering a ride. You see, those things are something, you know, you don't all do all of those things, but all of you can do something. And you have something at hand you could share. The willingness to pray for people. And that be a actual gift. So, we use what's at hand, and we're willing to be inconvenienced. You know, he shared his donkey. That was, you know, translate that forward. The modern version would say he lent him his truck, you know, and he shared his donkey. So that maybe we take a call when we'd plan to relax. On the other hand, you might need to relax, and you need to be able to listen that you not overextend. And you may have entered into a task that, or in a setting that you don't feel completely comfortable. I don't think you're all comfortable at Mustard Seed. I think you get exposed to some people there that live in a different world than some of you have been accustomed. But, you know, I remember overhearing some ladies once talk, and they were talking about a particular group, and said, we have nothing in common with those people. And there was a different lifestyle, and there was, you know, definitely different approach and different culture and different upbringing. But by my general observation, it seemed like they were all human. It seemed like they all had needs. It seemed like they all had vulnerabilities. I think they actually had much more in common. But you see, they just hadn't taken any length of time to find out who those other people were. And so they assumed they had nothing in common. As I listen to people and their stories, I think we have much more in common than we actually usually want to admit. The things that I hear others struggle with aren't things I've never struggled with. I might have done it in a different way. I might have chosen different approaches. But we're not so very different. We're much more in common. Have much more in common than we have in difference. So he recognized that more help was needed than he could offer. Some of us have trouble noticing that. So he took him to the inn. And when he took him to the inn, he asked for help. You see, he was part of the solution, but he wasn't all of the solution. Sometimes just knowing what is our part. And you see, we overwhelm ourselves because we think we can't do it all. Or we can't do it with everyone. Well, that's true. You not being God at all. But you can have a part. And so noticing which part could I respond to. And so that he took him to the inn, asked for help. And you see, some of you bring people our way to shalom. And we have more training or background in how to deal with some particular challenges. But there's people who come to us at shalom who need more and different help than we're equipped and trained to help. And we help get them on to other assistance where that's needed. Sometimes that's legal, sometimes that's medical, sometimes it's any number of things. We don't do it all, but we do some of it, and we're able to help in ways that others might not be able to. So we all have the limits of our own expertise, and there are those equipped for more specialized help, whether at the hospital, or at the garage, or at the mustard seed. And so we work together. This isn't just an individual project. But maybe one of the key things about this Samaritan was his generosity. Time and dollars. Well, denarii. The denarii was, in the Roman Empire, was what was considered a laborer's, like a tradesman kind of day's pay. You know, and so a silver coin that was considered a day's pay. So when it says he gave two coins, it isn't that he gave him 50 cents. What he gave him was 2 days' pay. Now some of you that are more math inclined will be kind of calculating that. Others of you would be thinking, I don't know what I make. But 2 days' pay isn't a small chunk of change to pass along in help of a stranger. And then he said, here's my Visa card. You know, put it on my card and we'll square up when I get back. Okay. You know, you never look more like God. You never look more like Jesus than when you're being generous. And now, the thing is, you might have to budget for that. In fact, you will have to budget for it if you make it a way of life. You see, you'll have to choose to live on less so you have more to share. But it's not a bad way of being a Jesus follower. To choose to live on less so you can share more. And you will leave an imprint on strangers or those near you to be seen in your generosity as considering how much can we help? Where can we help? How can we help? Now, you have to always measure and weigh that sometimes if we try to do too much, especially financially, but in other ways as well, we have to look and say, am I actually helping, or is it just fulfilling my need to rescue? Am I enabling them to carry on in an unhealthy way? And a good way to think about that is that we not do for people what they can do for themselves. And so to be able to measure that at some times we all need much more assistance. But then to be able to say once they're able to do for themselves, then we're not helping if we keep insisting on covering for them. So those are just some of the generosity and just a limit that we would be, you see, this Samaritan was open to overcoming social barriers. We heard a little bit last week that Samaritans were looked down upon by the Jews. So, in fact, the Jews had a saying that they were glad they weren't a dog or a Samaritan. You see, he had to look past that this fellow laying in the ditch needs help and he's a human being. Even if he was well, he probably wouldn't give me the time of day. He wouldn't have room for me. Well, you see, the interesting thing is we all have our prejudices. We may or may not be aware of them, but it may be how you think about the poor. You may assume they're lazy without knowing their story, or that they waste their money without knowing their story. Or you may have prejudice about the rich, you see, because they seem like they are independent, but they have hearts that break too. And they have needs, and they need assistance. Or those that seem too emotional. I can't deal with all that emotion. Or those that are so quiet and sullen that and they look so serious and they look crusty, and we write them off because, or their lifestyle. What kind of lifestyle they're living? And to say, well, but are they still people? Do they still matter? Or their language, or their cultural barriers, or their beliefs, or how they dress, or what their values are. We could find lots of reasons for saying this person doesn't matter. What I try to do is ask God what he sees and values in each of these people. And I ask him to open my eyes to what he values and help me respond to them in the way that would honor him. And I find that when I hear their story, what I thought were barriers break down. And I think this Samaritan did. In fact, he risked opening the door to relationship because he takes time with this guy. And he's with him overnight. And then he says, when I come back this way, I'll check in. And the value and beauty, you see, if the government just decides to bring over refugees and plunk them into communities, they're going to be alone and isolated and years till they integrate. But when people sponsor refugees and know them and love them and surround them, then the integration of them finding and making a new life can happen so much quicker because it's relational. Someone cares. Someone wants to see us succeed and thrive. Your volunteerism, that you get involved and you get to know the people. And so when you're at Mustard Seed, I hope there's a chance for you to engage in some interaction with some of the people and over time get to know them a little more. Find out the treasure God has in them. So it could be shoveling a walk. It could be writing a note or a card. Just yesterday, I was at a camp gathering, and my sister-in-law was there, and a woman, very, very grown now, I don't know how to estimate her age, she might have been 35, I don't know. She came up and wanted to see my sister-in-law, and she had with her a book that my sister-in-law had given her and had signed her name in, and a letter that she'd written her after she'd been at camp 1 year, 20 or more years ago. And that she said, I must have read this over 100 times. Who knew? Who knew what a simple kindness might offer? So, what is it to be a neighbor who loves? The kind of neighbor Jesus was describing? How is it possible? First, we have to find the source of love. We love because he first loved us. He loves us so much. You see, when Jesus was describing the Samaritan, in many ways he was describing himself. He left the comfort of glory. He had compassion. He saw that we were broken. He came to meet us on the roadside. He's here and present. He stopped. He risked. He showed his compassion. He carried our pain. He generously offered his life that we could live. Even though he sees our sin, he believes in what we're becoming. He stays with us, and he's coming back. He's a lot like the Samaritan. And it's when you accept and receive the love he has for you that you are empowered because he loved first and best. When we receive God's love, we can't stop ourselves from wanting to live it out in our lives. That's our way of loving God, surrendering our life's purpose to loving others the way he loves us. It's not us, it's supernatural. You see, because he not only shows us how to love, through his Spirit he gives us the power to love. You can be that sort of neighbor. Oh, not all the time. You're not that consistent. We can still tell you and Jesus apart. But more and more often, you could be doing that. You could be enjoying being that neighbor Jesus describes. He was that kind of neighbor to us. And he invites us to be that kind of neighbor to those around. You'll each have different opportunities because you're different people. You have different things at hand. You'll do it in different ways. And that's okay. Don't compare what you give to what someone else does. But it's by his power and by his love that, as Deuteronomy says, we will enjoy life. We enjoy life when it's purposeful and we can see what is good. When you live like this kind of a neighbor, God's kind of a neighbor, then you're making God's neighborhood a better place.